Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Cederstrom. And today we have an interesting day for reporting. We have Wendy Wilson joining us for the first segment of the show today. And I was pleased to talk to James Corbett last night. And it was a very interesting discussion that we had. So he will be joining us for the two segments after Wendy. So, and I want to welcome everyone to the show today. And today is August 8th. 2018. And so let's get right to the market report today. We have gold, and we have gold, up $2.60 today at $1,214. Silver was up at 6 cents today at $15.50. Platinum was up a dollar at $834. It was interesting to see that palladium broke away. It was down $12 at $900. So is that a reversal where palladium will be dropping and platinum will continue to increase and overtake the lead of palladium that we've seen for such a long time? USDX today was down 9 cents, still at 95 though, 95.09. Crude oil got hit today, down 2.31 at 66.86. And the paper markets today, we were hectic all day long today, and I didn't follow the paper markets today. Shame on me. The Dow was down 45 points at 25,583. The NASDAQ was up 4, 7,888. And the S&P basically unchanged, 2,857. 10-year yield holding at 297. Euro was up as much as gold, as the dollar was down. And really wasn't much other news. Bitcoin took a beating today, down about 6% at 6340. So discussions were all in the elections last night, and it's just we live in a crazy, crazy world. So with that, we're going to go to Wendy Wilson as she helps us to figure out how to stay uncrazy in this in the medical and keeping ourselves healthy. Good afternoon, Wendy.
Good afternoon, Melody. Yeah, we're going to get into crazy today.
Crazy.
Yeah, we got radio frequency chips in healthcare. You may know them as the RFID chips. Most people remember them, you know, the little tracking chips that, you know, pet owners would use on their pets to help find them if they're lost. And it was also promoted as an embedded chip in humans to store medical information. So this field of radio chip technology in healthcare is really exploding. And scientists are experimenting with RF chips from building tiny laboratories on chips and using them to transport medicines or stem cells in the human body, to the concept is leading to really endless possibilities, and all of them are really being explored. Now, RF chips often are referred to as RFIDs, and they're included now in a lot of clothing, product packaging, also used within law enforcement to track their case evidence. So more retailers are embracing chips in their products that they sell to deter theft and also to see when customers are returning to their stores. So we live in this attract world, unfortunately, Melody, and many believe that, you know, these chips are going to replace a lot of tangible currency in the form of embedded devices and also in an attempt to reduce identity theft. So, but will these chips be safe inside human bodies? So we're going to check it out. Now, over the last decade, the FDA did approve the RF tracking chips as implants for humans, and to use as a mean as identifying patients, so your patient records, for instance. So medical researchers in 2007 wanted to make advancements in this area, but caution due to unknown consequences. You know, they weren't sure the impact that these little tiny chips would offer inside the human body. Now, scientists described their skepticism in 2007 this way. One guy by the name of Ben Adia, he's with the Children's Hospital's informatics program in Boston. He says, if such devices become widely deployed, they may provide an incentive for both well and ill-intentioned parties. So, you know, people often think of these chips being read by scanners, that anyone could get. So it was sort of like reading a license plate. So that's why people were worried about the security of it all. But there's this new research out of Tufts University School of Engineering. In March of this year, 2018, they were reporting on these chips that are being used now in dentistry. Have you seen this?
No.
Ah, well, the military has been using these devices in dentistry for some time without anybody knowing about it. But now it's moved into the civilian area. Research from Tufts University is highlighting the use of these chips. They mount them on your tooth, and they monitor diabetic patients, their glucose levels.
Mm-hmm. I have heard about that, yes.
Okay, so the chip is actually transmitting information. It's receiving and transmitting information on the sugar level, so what the person is eating. So the research is stating that they intend to expand the use of these chips in dentistry to track patients' lifestyles via the nutrients, because the chemicals that in your foods, they affect the transmission waves on the wireless chips. So they know when you've had something salty or something with alcohol in it.
Well, they do that with cattle now. They have these dairy cows that are implanted and so forth, where they can read all about their sugars, their temperatures, and they can adjust their food.
That's where they started all this, is with cattle. This is where the chips started. So all this research with, the chips in our dentistry is in the Journal of Advanced Materials. But some people say, it's not a big deal. It's just, somebody has to have real close by to read it. But actually, some of these chips now have a very long transmission field. The Inter-University of Microelectronics Center in Belgium has been working on long-range RFID wireless sensor nodes for logistic reasons in these devices, and your smartphone can use it. And obviously, healthcare is liking it as well. So it has an area to transmit and receive over long distances. So here is what Bert Glycinic, he's with the Netherlands Host Center. He says, within our wireless autonomous sensor system, we aim to develop wireless sensor systems powered by energy harvested from the environment instead of using batteries. So it'll have an endless power supply. And then, of course, John Rogers, he's with the University of Illinois. He says, we will be tracking health and sustainability issues simultaneously with these biodegradable tools that are in research for a wide range of applications. So really, doctors and surgeons, their toolkit is expanding.
Wow, amazing.
Yeah. It is. So what we know now about how healthcare is using these chips, Melody, is they're using it to track a lot of inventory. So it's replacing a lot of this counting of inventory manually. From your patient gowns to tissue boxes, the chips are helping them get a clue as to, running it lean and mean. They're also using the chips on their equipment, their surgical tools, obviously to identify patients as well as to locate patients. And also pharmacy drugs are tracked now by chips. Also, they're chipping newborns, or they're putting bracelets with chips in them so the baby's not getting an implant. But you know what I'm saying? They have a bracelet with a chip in it. Also, employees with their security badges all are wearing chips. And also, the laundry department, bedding and towels, is also chipped now.
Are you kidding me?
No, everything's got tracking. Jim Harper, he's an attorney. He's an attorney with the Director of Information Policy.
You mean people's towels are tracked?
At the hospital.
Wow.
He's an attorney and Director of Information at Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. He says, tracking a patient on a gurney is one thing. Following ordinary citizens around in their daily lives is another. This is a very threatening activity to privacy. And Mark Robotti, he's the former editor of Information Week, he says, the RFID technology goes beyond barcodes for goods. RFID offers automatic tracking and can be read at a distance, and you don't need line of sight, end of quote. Goodness. So really, this chip tracking technology is going to offer really tremendous potential for control. So scientific medicine really wants to use the chips to help track also disease to its origin, or it's from the infected person. It's called trail of contact. So chip tracking can certainly, you know, help hospitals keep track of their stuff and maybe where their patients are. But getting people really to embrace a lot of this technology is the big question. Would you get a chip, Melanie? Would you?
No. No, okay. Absolutely not.
See, but I think, you know, our generation may bristle at it. I think the younger generation.
They're enamored with it. They think it's awesome.
Yeah, so if they have a bunch of people who don't volunteer to be chipped, it may at some point be mandated in order for you to keep health benefits and maybe even to buy or sell goods if they get rid of currency. So therefore, you know, the access to maybe a clinic or a hospital with these chips, you can see how this is going. You know, they'll roll you in the doors on the gurney from the ambulance and they read your chip automatically running through the door sensor. It pops up on their computer who you are, because on your chip is all your health data, your address, your phone number, your immediate family and their contact information, your driver's license, your car ownership, your bank accounts, and all your other assets, because the hospital will be paid.
And guess what? If you don't have one of those chips, you will not be admitted.
Well, you may take the back seat to everybody else that's coming in the door that's chipped. See, so one thing's for sure, though, as the cost of this technology comes down, the harder the campaign is going to be for applying it and for being it enforced. So right now, currently, healthcare is using these chips under the benefits, they say, of supply chain tracking, patient safety, and quality assurance. What do you think of that's? Do you think that's their reason for using chips?
Oh, sure it is.
Well, you and I think
absolutely.
You and I think like, because according to the Colorado State University report of 2013, they wanted to find out what the big deal was with hospitals using these chips in healthcare, in the industry. So they said they're using tracking chips. They estimate it's actually going to grow. The use of them is going to grow by 10 to 15% a year in healthcare. They say additionally that the use of the chips in the healthcare industry is strictly driven by financial pressures to gain competitive edges regardless of patient safety, their words. So it's not about making it safer for you, because that makes total sense. You know, it's all about the bottom line. So really, they're looking at overhead expenses. So they're monitoring right now employees and their interactions with patients to reduce employee staff and to cut hours. They're also looking at how they can run the facility leaner and meaner, few pieces of equipment needed. They're tracking their equipment, how often it's used, so they can reduce, you know, the need of having excess equipment and overhead. They're reducing their liability with this, and they're also improving hospital ratings for marketing purposes. So that's the real reason they're implementing RFID.
And you know what, with the cost of healthcare nowadays, the public will easily, you know, conform to whatever is, you know, promises that are given to them, as far as, you know, perhaps your rates will come down. You know, if we get to chip you and blah, blah, blah.
Well, you know, again, and, you just answered the question, money answereth all things, you know. Yeah. So, well, that's the thing. It, you know, it depends on who you ask or who you talk to about, you know, chip implants, pros and cons. You know, hey, the Swedish people are embracing chip technology and actually a currency, you know, they're going to the, you know, technology money. If you go to Sweden, your money's no good, Melanie. You have to have electronic money and only.
We know that the U.S. dollar isn't any good.
Well, what I'm saying is,
I know.
Bring your Visa card, because now over there, if you want to jump on a RAM, a trail, a bus, any kind of public transport, you have to have electronic money, or 3,000 Swedes have embedded chips in their hands, and that's their bank account. And they just run their hand over the scanner and they get on the bus. So that's how they do it. Other industries that are embracing chips, you want to take a guess? Who might be really in their product line? It's a product line.
It could be anything, Wendy.
Well, it's firearms. Manufacturers of firearms.
Yeah.
They're embedding technology in their guns that will read the chip of the gun owner, and if it's not you, the gun won't fire. And they say this will keep children safe and criminals won't be able to use stolen weapons. So, but here's the thing. Maybe you're home with your spouse. Somebody breaks in. Your spouse gets disabled. You pick up his gun. It ain't going to work for you.
It's not going to work.
Right? Well, let's see how safe, healthy these chips are if you put one in your hand. actually some medical research on this, on implanted chips. Guess what? These chips migrate in the body. They don't stay put.
I can't imagine that they would.
So other than that, they have impulse electrical hazards, adverse tissue reactions, infection. There's incompatibility with other medical equipment like MRI, CT, and X-rays. The chips offer negative interactions with other electromagnetic interference devices like defibrillators, you know, where they got to shock your heart. If you got a chip, I guess that's not happening. Also, there was a study between 1996 and 2007 where they found 10% of the lab animals that got chipped developed cancerous malignant tumors. And also, it makes you more vulnerable with criminal intention, people with criminal intentions, and it takes away your privacy because, you know, if you got tracking and a chip, and let's say, you know, you're a victim of domestic violence, they can find you.
Yes.
So there's a lot of ethical concerns, according to the National Library of Medicine. They don't know about such devices. You know, is there going to be informed consent? Is there privacy issues? Is there going to be accessibility issues to the information? Is there going to be transmission issues with the data? Who would be using it? So, I mean, they're just going ahead with this stuff, and not, and those questions really haven't been answered adequately. Nothing's really 100% secure, so how can they promise anything, really?
Yeah, I remember long, long ago we were talking about RFID, well, these chips, and how they create blisters on your body from what you just explained. And I believe there's the Bible talks about, you know, I guess Revelation where,
it emits a frequency, and we have electrical impulses in our body. That's how our heart and our nervous system work. So, I mean, if you're going to put another transmitter in there, you're going to have some issues. So I think people need to just, you know, do their due diligence, cleanse and nourish, keep their immune system working, and pray. But anyway, we have a summer harvest sale going on, Melody. So people will save 20% through Friday the 10th on their orders of $50 or more. So if they were thinking about cleansing, getting pandemic kits or any of that, they'll save 20%.
And what number should they call you?
Oh, toll-free in the U.S. and Canada, 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. Or visit thepowerherbs.com.
Yeah, it's really a fascinating and scary and frightening topic because we see where it's headed, and we see the youth, how they're so, you know, they love the technology, and hey, if they can walk through the store and not have to, you know, pull out a credit card or, you know, money, they'll love it. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, give Wendy a call at 866-229-3663. That's 866-229-3663. Thank you, Wendy. We'll talk to you next week. And James Corbett will be here right after this short break. And thank you for joining Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. And I'm Melody Cedarstrom, and I'm pleased to welcome back to the program James Corbett. And as you know, James is the founder and editor of the insightful Corbett Report, which he started in 2007, and later on became the editorial writer for the International Forecaster that was created by the economic analyst Bob Chapman and my friend. You can visit James' website at thecorbettreport.com, and you can also request a complimentary copy of the International Forecaster by going to their website, theinternationalforecaster.com. And a warm welcome to James. Thank you for joining us once again this evening.
Well, thank you for having me. Always a pleasure to be here.
And as I kind of like to start out the questions, if there's the program, as is there anything in particular on your mind that you would like to discuss or share with the listeners before we get started with some of my questions?
Well, I think the pressing issue for a lot of my audience in the last couple of days has been the issue of Internet censorship, social media censorship, which is a topic that keeps rearing its head over and over and over, and we're going to continue hearing about it and dealing with it in various forms over and over and over. But of course, the latest news, as I'm sure everyone has seen, has been Alex Jones and Infowars.com being censored from a number of different big tech platforms. But not just that. In fact, there was an interesting little altercation that developed on Twitter over the last couple of days that involved the director of the Ron Paul Institute, Daniel McAdams, and Scott Horden of the Libertarian Institute, and Peter Van Buren of WeMeantWell.com, who they were involved in some sort of Twitter altercation with some MSM-type person who was defending the government's record on lying about the Iraq War and things like that. And somehow it escalated to the point where all three of those aforementioned gentlemen got censored off of Twitter. Peter Van Buren had his Twitter page completely deleted, and Scott and Daniel McAdams are just suspended or in some sort of state where they can't post anything new to Twitter. So these types of issues, again, keep coming up again and again and again. But I am noticing a very disturbing trend now that's happening that I think is not a lot of people are picking up on, which is the idea that a few years ago, if you had mentioned the idea of the government getting involved to basically dictate what platforms can or cannot do and what who they can or cannot allow and that sort of thing, people would have recognized it, I think, generally speaking, for government intrusion, censorship of one form or another. But now I see a lot of people, including the very people that you would expect to be most up in arms about that, to be actually clamoring and desirous for this idea that the government is going to step in and regulate these social media platforms so they can't just censor people willy-nilly like this. It boggles my mind that people would believe that somehow the government is going to come in and be a fair and even-handed regulator of this and allow people like Alex Jones on these monopolies. It's wrong on every level. I mean, first of all, of course, the government is not there to be your friend and to look out for your best interests. They're going to use this as a political tool. And maybe, yeah, when the Republicans are in power, they'll use it more against Democrats. And when the Democrats are in power, they'll use it more against Republicans. But that tool of censorship will then be in the hands of government. And furthermore, I think this is exactly what the social media giants want. I think Twitter and Facebook and Google and YouTube want the government to come in and regulate the industry precisely to make them hardwire their status as these monopoly entities that must be protected, hardwire them into place. This is exactly what they want, because they don't want to go the way of MySpace or Dig or these other social media platforms that were huge several years ago. Now no one even remembers them because people migrated from those platforms. Better things came along and they moved. That is how things should work. Yes, these social media giants are horrible. People should not be using them, but alternatives already exist and people can freely move to them. That is the way we defeat this, not by clamoring for the government to step in and try to regulate all of this.
You know, you said it, and there was something that was just bothering me. And you know, it's just not the past couple of months. It's been going on for the last 2 years. There was a poll out. 43% of self-identified Republicans said that they believed the president should have the authority to close news outlets engaged in bad behavior. And I read that and I thought, and you're right, these are the same people that 5 years ago, or, you know, when did the campaign?
2 years ago, even.
Or when the first campaign started with Trump. You're right, they would have been outraged.
Well, of course, and they will be outraged again when the pendulum swings and the next Obama or, you know, Hillary or whoever takes over again in 2020 or 2024. Suddenly it'll be, oh no, now the president has too much power. It's the same idiotic mentality. Let's give this person that we like with the power to do whatever he wants and then freak out when it goes into the hands of someone we don't like.
I mean, for a very long time, we knew who controlled the media. We and you're right. It is their agenda. They're getting exactly what they want. The people are behaving exactly how they want them to behave. Do you believe the media? I mean, I don't know if this is the right question to ask, but to some degree, they are the enemy of the people.
Yes, I mean, the media is just such a broad blanket term these days, you know, that could apply to anything. But I think the spirit of that sentiment, when we're talking about propaganda outlets like CNN or MSNBC or in the broader international context, a BBC or an Australia Broadcasting Corporation or things like that. I mean, these are propaganda outlets and should be recognized as such. And yes, to that extent, they are the enemy of the people. Yes. But again, the question is, well, who is going to take care of that? And if you were putting the power in the hands of a president to come along and declare, you know, this outlet is the enemy of the people and thus must be removed, to think that that is a good idea that is not going to be abused is insanity. It's just total nonsense. And the only way people can delude themselves into believing that is if they have so bought into this left-right delusion that they are willing to literally give whatever power, anything, absolutely anything, to their guy when he's in power. And it's the stupidest, short-sightedest thing, but it's incredibly effective, and a lot of people fall for it over and over and over.
But this time, it's a little different this time, because I think we're at a point in time in history, whatever you want to call it, it's very dangerous. And I don't see it actually changing or going back. I feel like this is going to peak. I feel like something nasty is coming our way because of this. We see our whole political, here in the States, we just had polls, we had voting today in various states and so forth. It seems like the Republicans were able to hold Ohio and so forth. But yet you see all these socialists that are beginning to become more in the news, which is part of that propaganda. All of those candidates did lose the primaries today. So maybe that is just a little quick nilly that is going to go away. But where does it go from here, James? I mean,
right. I think you point out something important, which is that what we're dealing with, I guess, could be analogized to pulling on the rubber band. And the tension is there, and it's pushing the poles apart, and it's getting worse and worse. And, of course, as you pull apart on the rubber band, the elastic tension, the energy, the potential energy grows and grows and grows. And the question is, well, will the rubber band break, or will the left thumb slip and it'll go flying off to the right, or will the right thumb slip and it'll go flying off to the left? There's lots of ways that this could happen, but the one that seems least likely is that the tension on that rubber band will just gradually go down so that the rubber band can go back to normal. That's not going to happen. I mean, it's just a question of which way this is going to break. And I think that is, unfortunately, that's the dynamic of the situation. We are reaching some sort of crisis point. And so many different trends converge on this, not just the political, but also the financial and economic, and also this internet online culture and the dissemination of information, and this talk about Russian meddling and all of this. All of these things seem to be converging on a certain point. And I don't know. I don't know which way that's going to break, but it doesn't look like it'll be a happy break.
No, it doesn't. And, of course, everything else is, the first domino. And, again, you mentioned the financial, and we'll talk about that a little bit later on in the program. But, I guess we're going to, travel around with the most common popular topics in the news and so forth. And I guess we have to talk a little bit about Iran and the sanctions are being reimposed on Iran, and I guess they started. And hours after Monday's announcement, European officials had registered their opposition to these new sanctions, and they said they want to remain parties to the Iran agreement. You have Russia, China, Britain, France, Germany, and the EU, who want to work to maintain these financial channels with Tehran. Daimler, they put their business agreement with Iran on hold, and that's not surprising with the threat from President Trump to place tariffs directly on their luxury line of vehicles that came into the United States. So, question. Regime change. If it comes, will it be more of a result of war or other external manipulation or, some sort of internal grassroots action or any at all?
There is a genuine dis-ease going on in Iran right now with the way the economy has been handled and the way the things are melting down at the moment. And I think people have heard about the incredible inflation that's happening there in Iran right now. And, of course, the sanctions, which are just now snapping back into place, are definitely not going to help things and are going to exacerbate the situation. So, clearly, I think it's a horrible situation, and the Iranian people are probably quite rightly quite angry with their government and the way things are going. But I think it's impossible to separate all of this out from the outside manipulations that have been going on, not just for years, but really decades, half a century or more, if you want to look back at Iran. And I did a podcast earlier this year about the Iran protests that we saw at the beginning of the year and how they were being clearly, I think, not staged by outside interests, but promoted by outside interests that are, of course, always looking to drive the wedge further in any target nation. Iran is clearly a target nation now, so I think there's a mixture that goes on. There is genuine unhappiness in the population of Iran, but I think that unhappiness is going to be fostered and stirred and magnified by the media, who can, of course, always make something into a pressing issue for people in the United States or elsewhere by just hammering it home every single night. This is the new thing that we must all be concentrating on, and look at this horrible thing that's happening in Iran, which we all know it will only, that attention will only last as long as the warmongers' attention on the country lasts. Exactly as it did in Libya in 2011, when every night we were being told about the horror stories of Gaddafi and the Gaddafi government, and these valiant protesters were rising up against Gaddafi, and we've got to support him, and every single night we were hearing about it on the news. And of course now, 7 years later, does anyone even remember Libya? What's Libya? Oh yeah, open slave markets now operating in Libya. Oh, who cares? That's yesterday's news. Again, just the focusing of attention can be such an important part of all of this. So I have a feeling we're going to see a lot of attention being focused on Iran right now as part of a international campaign that's going to be ramping up in that enemy of the people media, which interestingly seems to be in line with the Trump administration on this, in trying to oust the current Iran regime. And I'm not defending the current Iranian government by any means, but I'm saying we have to be aware that there are outside forces that are looking to exacerbate tensions that are there. And this is all, of course, taking place in the context of the sanctions, which are about to further cripple the Iranian economy.
Could these also be you know, focusing on Iran to as a distraction from what's happening in North Korea. I mean, we have, I believe it was after the summit, you had Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. He said he might be prepared to return to North Korea for another meeting. John Bolton said that North Korea has not taken the proper steps toward denuclearization, despite the agreement between our two countries. So, they kind of play hand in hand, don't they?
Yeah, well, actually quite literally, because the latest news is that North Korea's foreign minister has just made a visit to Iran. So kind of brings those stories right together, doesn't it? Clearly, I think we can see these things swirling around, and there are obvious parallels to draw, like the type of rhetoric that Trump was using against North Korea last year, for example, and, we're gonna show them our power and all of that kind of stuff, and then suddenly meeting with Kim. And similarly, of course, as everyone saw recently, Trump tweeting we can bring consequences the likes of the world has never seen before to Iran, and then subsequently saying, well, I might meet with your, you know, Iranian leaders. So, art of the deal or whatever, as I'm sure the Trump supporters would say. But essentially, this is keeping the focus on Iran at the moment, because they are clearly coming into sight as in the crosshairs. And I think there is the bigger story here is the sort of world historical story, is that there is, obviously, Iran is dealing from a position of extreme weakness here, but it further exacerbates a tension that I've talked about before, where countries like Iran and Russia and China and all of these countries that are being targeted by the U.S. in one form or another, economically or even militarily, are being driven further and further into each other's arms and being incentivized to create the alternative financial and trading infrastructure to go around the United States. And again, no one nation here could really stick up to the United States as the current ruler of the world order as it exists right now. But as they start to band together and come up with their, for example, China's alternative SWIFT system and things like this, there is a chance that they are going to start truly competing with the existing United States-led world monetary or IMF, World Bank type of infrastructure that exists, and really putting on a serious threat to that American hegemony on the table. Which the bigger picture that I like to look at is that I think this is all being planned by the types of, you know, plan makers, the kingmakers who have always existed behind the scenes, who really don't care about the United States as an entity. They just care about maintaining their power over the greatest share of the world population as possible, whether that power resides in Washington, D.C., or, hey, 20 years from now, maybe it'll reside in Beijing. I think the would-be world planners don't really care.
Well, you know, I read briefly that there was Iran was purchasing a lot of gold, and of course the sanctions that was placed on them, they were prohibited for importing any type of gold and so forth. So it's interesting that a country can place those types of sanctions on another country, as far as, you know, even the sanctions on countries from the from the European Union, sanctions being placed on them if they do business with Iran. I just find that amazing, and maybe it's common practice for these countries, for the United States. Maybe they've done it before and I'm just unaware, but I am aware of a break that we're heading into, so we'll be right back right after these few short commercials. So thank you for joining and listening to Financial Survival.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm joined today with James Corbett of the Corbett Report. And as a reminder, just in case we run out of time at the end of the program today, make sure you visit his website at thecorbettreport.com. And also, you can request a complimentary copy of the International Forecaster by going to their website, theinternationalforecaster.com. And we always run a special in there, so if you do have a, if you are a subscriber to the International Forecaster, you can always purchase our little package that we have in there, and you'll get your free renewal of your International Forecaster. Well, it was certainly, as you mentioned during the break, a very good first segment of the program, and now we're going to continue. I love doing these shows with you, James, because I kind of like get to go around the world and get a different perspective from someone that who lives in Japan, and get a different view and take on everything. And of course, Venezuela has been in the news a lot lately. You know, there's been predictions of inflation hitting 1,000,000% by year's end. We've also read that Maduro has sought to tighten its hold on power as opponents complain of economic mismanagement, corruption, and political oppression. That's kind of fun. Also, there was a assassination attempt. I guess there's some questions on whether it was or whether it wasn't. We witnessed this weekend by a drone exploding fairly close to him. Where do you see this country headed? Should the U.S. be involved? And do you believe that was an assassination attempt on Maduro?
Second question first, should the U.S. be involved? The answer is no, and should be a strong no, because I think Venezuela is one of those, it's one of those topics where a lot of people have a very set and determined viewpoint on this, that it's, oh, this is a socialist country that's falling apart, as all socialist countries do, or that this is a benevolent peace country that is being attacked by the outside powers in the United States. And I think there is a little bit of both going on, and we can't really separate those things out. I mean, yes, this is a failed socialist state that is clearly not doing well, but there are elements of that that really are because of outside interference and manipulation, and it's not outlandish to think of an assassination attempt on Maduro, precisely because we know about the coup attempt that the U.S. was actively involved in Venezuela in 2002, let alone some of the other things they were doing during the era of Chavez. So we know that Venezuela has been in the crosshairs of the U.S. State Department for a very long time, so it's not outlandish to think about it in general. Now, as to the specific drone assassination attempt that you're referring to there, I haven't looked into it to myself myself, so I can't really come to any sort of profound statement about whether or not that was real or what happened there. But again, I think just dismissing it out of hand would be inappropriate. And clearly, whether or not this is all because of outside intervention or all because of socialist mismanagement or some combination of the two, as I tend to believe, at any rate, the average person in Venezuela is really feeling the pinch. This is really starting to hurt in profound ways. And the Irish Times has an interesting way of putting it. They're saying that life in Venezuela, where a monthly wage buys just 15 beers. I'm not sure when we started measuring wage in beers, but anyway, that's something I guess a lot of people can relate to. So there you go. But clearly the country is dysfunctional at this point. The economy is crashing. But is the answer for the United States to step in some manner? Well, I would say decidedly not, especially right. because the United States has specifically targeted Venezuela for regime change in the past. They are clearly not the arbiters that anyone would think is going to be the peaceful third party that should be involved here. Now, clearly, some of the neighboring nations might have more to do with this, and Brazil, for example, is trying to deal with right now with the idea of migrants sneaking across the border from Venezuela as Venezuela starts to collapse, and they've just apparently reopened their border after having closed it briefly. So I think the other nations surrounding Venezuela are going to have to deal with it more, and probably should be more active in dealing with whatever is happening right now in Venezuela.
Well, you know, Zimbabwe, and I don't know if there's any correlation between the two, but if I remember correctly, Zimbabwe, their currency was saved because they started dealing in U.S. dollars, and that is what helped turn them around. So what would the difference? Why wouldn't the United States go in there? I mean, as far as helping them with dealing with dollars in Venezuela, is that
right?
Or is it just two different scenarios?
So the Venezuelan case, I think, is what we can point to with the socialist management disaster, is that, of course, the government wants to strictly manage that exchange rate between the Venezuelan currency and the U.S. dollar. And because of that strict control, then you have the black market developing for the quote-unquote the real price of U.S. dollars. What will people actually pay in order to get their hands on U.S. dollars, which are obviously seen as a more stable currency? And that's when you start to see the real discrepancies taking place. But you also, and now there's the 21st century twist on this, because it was being reported a few years ago when some of the troubles in Venezuela were really starting to manifest, that all of a sudden Venezuela was becoming a hotspot for Bitcoin and cryptocurrency mining, mm-hmm. because people were finding that they could make a month's wages just running a cryptocurrency miner for a few days. And this was becoming a thing until, of course, the Venezuelan market government started cracking down on it. And then they released their oil-backed cryptocurrency, which is neither oil-backed nor really a cryptocurrency, but that's a debate for another day, I guess. But these are the types of things that the Venezuelan government is doing to try to crack down on the people who are naturally trying to find ways around this. The people want to get their hands on U.S. dollars because they see it as more stable than the Venezuelan currency. So, of course, the Venezuelan government regulates that, and it's illegal, and people have to go to the black market. And people want cryptocurrency because it's seen as more stable and as a better resource to be investing in than the Venezuelan currency. So, of course, the Venezuelan government steps in and tries to stifle it. I think that's the real issue here, is the Venezuelan government trying to get in the way of the people to stop the glorious socialist utopia from happening, when, of course, people are trying to live the everyday real life of existence in this failed state.
Speaking of failed cities, Chicago, we've been talking a lot about on the program, my program, during the week about the universal basic income, and the city council is looking to approve a proposal to start handing out $500 a month to about 1,000 families in Chicago. And I don't think you can really compare this to what is in place in Alaska. I mean, people still get a check, but it is based on what is sold from their oil, not exactly freebie from the government and so forth. Well, nothing's a freebie from the government, but why do so many people believe that it's the government's responsibility to provide a safety net for people?
Yeah, that's the real question, isn't it? That's the root question. And I think that has to do with a process of indoctrination that's been going on for generations now, at least since the Great Society and the New Deal and all of that, where the expectation has been, well, you know, we need some lender of last resort, provider of last resort. We need someone to take care of the weak and the elderly and what have you. Well, then that has to be the government. That is what the government's role is. If it is there for anything, it is there to take care of us, cradle to grave. And that mentality has definitely seeped in and become stronger and stronger. I think it's always been there in a lot of countries around the world. I'm Canadian. I'm kind of socialist by default or socialist by birth. Luckily, I escaped that indoctrination, but I think that's just the way people tend to think of the government. But it's surprising to see that mentality coming on more and more strongly in places like the United States, which has always been more individualistic and liberty-minded. And again, I think that couldn't happen overnight. That had to have been a process of indoctrination over a very long time. But of course, as always, it's based on fundamentally flawed premises, including, of course, the question that's never interrogated with these kinds of schemes is, well, what is this money that is being given to these people in these universal basic income schemes, and where is it coming from? What is it based on? And you know, how does that money get created, and by whom, and under what circumstances? Those are the questions they never want you to think about. It's just money. It grows on trees, and they're giving it out like it's candy. And then, of course, the other question, whenever there's a government program like this involved, is, okay, well, what strings are attached to this? Because, of course, the whole premise of universal basic income is supposed to be every single citizen, everyone gets the same automatic amount every month. It's just automatically put in your bank account, and so there's no government bureaucracy or hoops or red tape or anything. There's no strings attached. It's just free money. But... And then you actually listen to the debates that are going on right now about universal basic income, and I listened to the one on the World Economic Forum. I believe it was last year in 2017 they were talking about this, and every single one of the panelists, they had their different ideas about UBI and whether it can be implemented and how much and all that sort of thing. They all had different opinions, but every one of them thought, well, of course, this is going to have to be tied to something, some sort of civic service of some sort. You'll have to jump through a certain hoop or, you know, make sure that you get your shots from the government or whatever it is. Every single panelist believed that, of course, this has to come with some sort of strings attached, and that's ultimately the way this is going to go. If it ever gets implemented, it would be just the most blatant and most obvious reach of the government's claws into people's lives to tell them how to act and how not to act. And we all see how that can go in a place like China, where, of course, now they're barring people from taking planes and trains and things because they're not good citizens and they don't have good social credit scores. Well, how long before universal basic income is tied to some sort of social credit scheme in the West and wherever else? But I suppose if there's any interesting news to come out of this, it's just that earlier this month it was reported that Ontario, Canada, which was running, I believe, the world's largest universal basic income trial experiment, there was this town where they were providing 4,000 people with, I think it was up to $17,000 Canadian dollars annually, something along those lines. Anyway, they just pulled the plug on that, and with very little explanation. Apparently, the Ontario Minister of Children, Community and Social Services told the reporters that the project was just too expensive and clearly not the answer for Ontario families. So there you go. I mean, there's the largest experiment that's been run yet on this scheme. It has just suddenly been canceled early because it was not working and was too expensive. That's got to tell you something.
Yes, it should. But it just amazes me how this is gathering steam here in the United States, and it's just and you hear these Democrats, these democratic socialists, as they call themselves, just touting it, and just it boggles the mind. They think that government can just print money. Well, the government will just print money. And you're right, you know, like it just grows on trees. And, you know, there was a couple of other articles in Japan's online website. The first reports that Japan's real wage growth hit a 21-year high in June. And it looks like wages grew faster than inflation at a rate of 2.8% in June after 1.3% real increase in May. Here in the United States, we still see our wages, they lag behind inflation, and basically our economy is being driven by, you know, more than $1 trillion stock buybacks. Would you like to comment on that, please?
Yes. I guess this is what people have been waiting for and hoping for. Really, that was the original promise of the whole Abenomics thing back when Shinzo Abe became prime minister here several years ago, was that this was going to transform the economy and it was going to get things going again, and that was going to filter down to the people. Well, obviously, those wages have not been filtering down for many years now. There has been growth in corporate Japan, but a lot of that growth being fueled, as we've talked about before, by the Bank of Japan basically just pumping money into the Japanese stock markets. But that has not translated into higher wages until this recent data, which shows an uptick and is seen as a positive, but in fact, a lot of the spike that we're seeing right now is actually coming from increased overtime and bonus payments, not from actual wage increases. So that's one thing, the giant asterisk to put on these numbers. And the other thing, I think we'll have to hold judgment, believe it when we see it, because of course with the threat of global trade disruption in this era of sanctions and trade wars and what have you, clearly means that an export-dependent economy like Japan is very much hanging in the balance, and things could go sharply down very quickly. So I think optimism, sure, let's be happy for good news when it comes, but I think we have to temper that with a little bit of realistic assessment of where this is coming from. And as I say, I don't think anything in the Japanese economy can be taken without a little grain of salt, given that the Bank of Japan is essentially just pumping money like there's no tomorrow into the bond and stock markets here.
It's kind of like our GDP, 4.1%, right?
Yeah. Or record low unemployment when most people are just employed in part-time or contract labor.
Yep. There was another article, and we're just about out of time, about a Japanese corporate giant NEC to develop a facial recognition system for the 2020 Summer Olympics. Any final comments on that? I think we're just about out of time.
Yeah, the Summer Olympics 2020 is going to be interesting. I think they're going to roll out a lot of different things like that, facial recognition. They're also talking about driverless taxis and other nifty things that'll make things so convenient for the tourists here. And we'll definitely have to see what kind of stuff they roll out.
Well, we'll have to talk about that on the next program. James, thank you so much for joining me today. And ladies and gentlemen, you too, thank you for listening to Financial Survival. We'll be back tomorrow. Until then, be safe, good night, and God bless.
And still there never seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. In my